The end of the last lecture turned out to be like a celebration of sign errors made in real time on the blackboard. So I want to start by just writing down, rewriting down some equations just to make sure I have all the signs right. So here's the metric we're going to be using in the ADN variables. And its inverse metric we showed by a matrix factorization trick was equal to this. There is a unit normal vector, which I had defined. I want to change the sign convention for that. So that with the upper index, the zeroth component has the positive sign. If we think of a vector with an upper index as being a direction, then this sign convention will make the unit normal vector point in the time direction rather than the reverse time direction. Now, another way of writing this equation for the inverse metric, which turns out to be really convenient for calculations, is to write it like this. You can see by inspecting this formula that the extra terms here besides the G3 are just the components of the outer product of the vector n v with itself and the minus sign. And I want to write that in a non-matrix form like this. Where this notation is a little silly in this example with only two indices, but in examples with more indices, it will help keep track of which things are paired with which. The Kronecker delta with one Greek index and one Roman index means that the Greek index goes from 0 to 4, and the Roman index goes from 0 to 3, and the Roman index goes from 1 to 3. It's 0 if they're equal, or it's 1 if they're equal, and it's 0 if they're not equal, including the case where the upper index is 0 and the lower index is anything. All right. Now the extrinsic curvature is defined by we motivated last time defining the intrinsic curvature by taking I want to take the covariant derivative of the normal vector. That's the covariant derivative as computed by a four observer. And then I want the projection of that into the tangent plane of the hypersurface. So I only want to consider, this could be a four vector index, but if I only choose to consider its spatial part, then that's the definition of the intrinsic curvature. And that's just the definition, but we motivated it last time. Okay. So with this setup and this definition, I want to derive some results. The results are that we're going to use are the first Gauss-Kedossian equation and the ADM formula for the Einstein-Hilbert action. And so I'm going to start computing stuff. And the first thing I want to compute is an explicit formula for the extrinsic curvature in these ADM variables. We can work out the right-hand side in terms of N, Ni, and Gij. And so the first step is just to write out the covariant derivative. And then notice that this is zero, because in the formula for eta, with the index lowered, all of the spatial indices are zero. So this is zero just because I'm choosing to only look at the spatial indices. And then likewise, there's only one non-zero term in this contraction, and I just get n gamma ij for zero. So now we just need to calculate this Christoffel symbol using gamma 4, using the standard formula. I found a really nice way to speed up these calculations, which is making you guys do all the work. So at several points during the lecture, I'm only going to talk about derivations when I think they're kind of conceptually interesting. And I'll leave pieces like this, which are nice exercises and don't involve any weird tricks, dot, dot, dots will be in one-to-one correspondence with problems in problem set 2, which I will send out later today. So it's a homework problem to show that this, if you compute this Christoffel symbol, you end up with the following explicit formula. Now, in this ADM setup, when I say that I compute things, what I usually mean is that I compute them in terms of three-dimensional covariant quantities. So the extrinsic curvature it looks like a time dependent of the three metric, plus this covariant quantities. These are covariant derivatives with respect to the three metric. I should put the three in there. I think I have it in my notes. With the indices lowered using the three metric. Okay. So I want to derive some more formulas relating three-dimensional and four-dimensional objects. It helps have some sort of geometric picture. So here's an identity which is so intuitive that you might use it without even realizing you're using it. Let's put a question mark over it, because it's something we don't know is true a priori, but have to prove. Here's something that seems geometrically plausible. If I take the, I want this to be true in the case where x and y are transverse vector fields, which means that they're tangent to the constant time hypersurface. So it makes some intuitive sense that if I have a curved hypersurface and then I have some tangent vector field, a four observer calculates the covariant derivative in some other tangent direction x, that the result that they get, well, they'll see a normal component. The four observer will see a normal component, which has something to do with the curvature of the surface that the three observer doesn't get to see. But the part of the four observer's covariant derivative, which is tangent to the surface, would agree with the covariant derivative as calculated by the three observer. Turns out to be true, but it's not obvious. So let's prove. Let's do a calculation to try to show that this is true. So what you need to calculate, I'll show this at the end, is a Christoffel symbol with two lower spatial indices. And the upper index, I need it in two cases, where it's either a zero or a spatial index. We've already computed, by the way, the case where the upper index is a zero. That is to say, we just computed it by defining it. Well, we just defined it to be n to the minus 1 times the intrinsic curvature. Or I guess we did give a formula for it. So we really only need, the only part of this calculation that's new is the part where rho is spatial. But it's actually convenient to calculate, do the calculation with, in both cases at once, with rho as a Greek index. All right, so let's calculate that. So I'll go to the standard formula. And then I'll split the contraction over sigma into a... Oh, no, sorry, I lied. What I'm actually going to do in this step is take this inverse metric and plug in this form for it. Let's make that rho... trying to figure out how to do all these calculations, and I found that this identity, this way of writing the inverse metric, was a tool that really made all the calculations work nicely. I'm going to use that formula about 5 times. Okay, now what I have here, so looking at the if I look at the part of this where this guy contracts with the right-hand side, then the purpose of these... Oh, sorry, this should be upper. Okay. So these delta functions just mean that I go over here on the right-hand side and replace rho where it appears by sorry, right? This delta function means that I go over here and replace sigma where it appears by L. And you can recognize that. So if I pull out the delta rho k, then I can recognize that as just the three Christoffel symbol. Right, if I plug in L for sigma and contract with G3KL, then what I have with the 1/2 is the usual formula for the three Christoffel symbol. It doesn't matter if I have an ordinary partial derivative of the metric with all spatial indices. It doesn't matter whether that metric is G3 or G4. plus another piece, which I'll just... I won't bother computing because there's a nicer way to get it at the end.
Shouldn't it be a k instead of an l in the Christoffel?
Oh, yes, thank you. Thanks. Where I didn't compute xij, I could compute it. But I just get some mess with an eta rho in front. The easiest thing to do is just to notice that I defined this Christoffel symbol with the zero index to be the intrinsic curvature. So if I just take rho equals zero on both sides, then I get n to the minus 1 times the intrinsic curvature on the left-hand side. Taking rho equals 0 here, I get 0 in the delta function. Xij times n to the minus 1 on the right-hand side. So it follows that the xij here is just the intrinsic curvature. That's just kind of a little trick for avoiding computing it. If you do compute it, if you work it out, then you'll end up getting this formula and getting the intrinsic curvature in another way. that's my formula for the Christoffel symbol. Some of the signs here, by the way, are different in the Euclidean case. In this Minkowski, or in this Lorentzian case, the metric has inner product minus one, or the unit normal vector has inner product minus one. In this formula, in the Euclidean case, this formula has a minus sign. That's why I kept getting confused about the signs the other day, because I was looking in a book where it was doing the Euclidean case. Okay. So I've computed this Christoffel symbol, where computed is understood to mean computed a 4D thing in terms of a 3D thing. This does imply this identity, and it also shows that the normal component of the 4 covariant derivative is given by the intrinsic curvature, the two vectors contracted with the intrinsic curvature. So that's another way of thinking about the intrinsic curvature. Instead of taking the covariant derivative of the normal vector, if a four observer and a three observer parallel translate vectors around, their computations differ by some amount that points in the normal direction, which is given by the intrinsic curvature. Okay, now I'll talk about the Gauss-Kedazzi equation. And I'll derive the Gauss-Kedazzi equation. This is actually the first Gauss-Kedazzi equation. And this derivation is going to be an outline in which I skip a little bit of algebra and just say what you get. You will fill in the steps as a homework problem. So if I consider the Riemann curvature with three lower spatial indices. But just like this Christoffel symbol, the computation ends up being a little bit nicer if I let the upper index be either 0 or a spatial index. I want to compute that. Let's write out its definition. And then I'll start working on the various terms that appear. So the first term works out to be, after some calculation, can be written in the following form. So I just aimed for an expression in which, I know that one of the terms that's going to appear is the same thing, but with a gamma 3 instead of a gamma 4, plus some additional corrections. And those corrections turn out to be of this form. This stands for any terms in the calculation which ended up being proportional to A to sigma, plus some prefactor that has indices ijk. I didn't bother keeping track of those terms because they'll go away in the end. The next term, so these pairs of terms in the Riemann curvature tensor are just related to each other by exchanging I and j. So I'll calculate this term, and I'll next calculate this term. So after some calculation, I got this. There's the unsurprising term, which is just obtained by replacing gamma 4s by gamma 3s, plus whatever delta functions you need to make the indices make sense, plus this term. I chose not to. You can further unpack this second term in such a way that, well, let me also say there's this guy on the right-hand side. You can choose to unpack the second term so that gamma 3 appears instead of gamma 4 with a new, you know, a new term. But the calculation, a little trick here is that the calculation just comes out a lot cleaner if you leave it as gamma 4. So there was a little choice made here to write some of the terms in terms of gamma 3 and some of the terms in terms of gamma 4. I experimented a little bit to see how the calculation would work out the best.
I think one of the sigmas is gamma in the second term. Is gamma?
It is impossible that I made a mistake writing this. No, just kidding. This should be... Thanks. Okay. And then, so there are some dot, dot, dots here. This is not something that's supposed to be obvious. And then when I plugged everything in, I got the following expression after a little calculation. So I got the, the expected term with Riemann 4 replaced by Riemann 3. These K terms combine just give you the 4 covariant derivative. And then... when you put in the terms that are related by the k to minus k symmetry, you also get this. Plus a bunch of things proportional to a to sigma. So now, if I lower the index, the sigma index using the 4 metric, so if I lower that index and also consider the case where it is a spatial index L, then you'll find, after a little calculation, that you just get the 3 curvature here. Here, when I lower this index and specialize it to a spatial index, I get the intrinsic curvature, another factor of the intrinsic curvature by definition. By definition of the intrinsic curvature. Likewise here. And these terms just go away, because when I lower the index with the 4 metric to get a to lower sigma, and then take that index to be spatial, then I get 0, because a to with the lowered index has 0 spatial components. And this is the first Gauss-Kadazy equation that relates the Riemann curvature tensor on the hypersurface to the ambient Riemann curvature tensor, plus some terms involving the extrinsic curvature. So in a homework problem, I'll ask you to fill in these steps and also keep track of these extra pieces where I didn't give you the hint for what they should be. If you keep track of these pieces, then you can also get the second Gaskinazzi equation, which is also an interesting identity. I'm doing well on time. Okay. The last calculation is sort of a long one, and I decided not to make this one a homework problem, so I'll go through more of the steps. Is the Einstein-Hilbert action? There's this very famous way of rewriting this in a 3+1 dimensional way in ADM variables, which is called the ADM action. It has the very nice property that it explicitly tells you which fields are dynamical versus non-dynamical. By the way, when numerical relativists evolve Einstein's equations, like let's say you want to simulate some black holes, they use something like the ADM action, not something like the written in a 3+1 dimensional way. Not the Einstein-Hilbert action. Actually, for reasons that I don't personally understand, the ADM action is apparently not good enough. It has numerical instabilities. And they use something fancier called the NSSM action, I think. It's in the list of interesting sounding things that I haven't had time to learn about yet. So what we're going to do is try to write this action in a 3+1 dimensional way by using this magic identity for the inverse metric with etas in it that's circled up there in that board. And so when we do that, we're going to get some terms where the g4s are replaced by g3s. And we'll also get some terms in which the g4s are replaced by etas. And it's convenient to build up those terms incrementally. So let's start with a term. Start by considering a term where I had 4 etas. This is one of the terms that we'll get when we substitute in for the inverse metrics. So this is 0 because the Riemann curvature tensor has anti-symmetry properties in this pair of indices and also this pair of indices, which means that if we're contracting it with something symmetric, then you always get 0. So that was easy. Now I want to consider a case where I have one factor of... So the nicest way to do it was to... Consider the case of 2 etas followed by a g4. This ends up having a nice expression, 3+1 dimensional expression. And calculating this integral is the hardest part of the calculation. In the first step, I'm not going to really do anything. I'm just going to shuffle things around to make the curvature piece easier to interpret. Now this should be a G4. Now this particular contraction of the Riemann curvature with eta, you can recognize as the following commutator of covariant derivatives. You usually we do this in reverse. Some commutator of covariant derivatives comes up in a calculation, and we replace it by a contraction involving the Riemann curvature tensor and the field being differentiated. But here we're going in reverse because I want to do some integrations by parts with these covariant derivatives. Let's see. So here's another step where I...
Sorry. How is it exactly that we lowered the rho in the...
Oh, yes, thanks. This should have been eta rho. Thanks. This I had this index wrong. This one is correct.
Yeah.
Thanks. Okay. So here I really didn't do anything. I just put in this delta function. Now the next step, I want to do some integrations by parts. So it's important for in this step that this is the square root of minus g4, and these are four covariant derivatives. I'll just do some integrations by parts to move this covariant derivative over here. And likewise in the second term, and this switches the signs. All right. Now some of the terms which appear can be simplified. For example, the four divergence of eta. This is one of the factors. Can be simplified in the following way. Let me write it as like this. Writing it this way is nice because I have an identity for this g4 that's equal to delta. So I have this identity that lets me make progress. And then I also define the extrinsic curvature in terms of this object with, in the case where both of the indices are lowered. So in this first term, the delta functions tell me to just replace mu nu on the right-hand side by ij. And that is the extrinsic curvature. So the first term here is just the extrinsic curvature traced with the 3 metric. And then the second term is 0. All right, plus 0. Because even without the contraction with eta mu, if I take the covariant derivative of eta nu and contract it with an eta nu, then this is 1/2. That's 0 because eta is a unit normal vector field. That's 1/2 of this, which is 0 because this is always minus 1. So this had a nice 3 plus 1 dimensional expression. And then a similar argument shows that this particular contraction is equal to two copies of the extrinsic curvature, self-contracted with the three metric. So putting everything together, the integral here in part two comes out to this. So this was two etas and a g4. Okay, now suppose that we go to the Einstein-Hilbert action. And replace each of the four metrics that appears by its expression involving the three metric and, make sure I'm doing this right, should be rho minus eta rho. And then there's a factor involving J and L. And then the four than the four curvature? Okay. So now it's kind of clear what to do, right? If I something that I should have said about this formula the answer would have been the same if I had replaced the g4 here by a g3, and the appropriate delta functions to make the indices make sense. That's because g3 and g4 just differ by a term of the form eta eta. I showed in part one that if I had two more etas here, I would get zero. So it didn't really matter that this was a G4 instead of a G3. The other thing that you can see is that if I switch these factors, if I had taken this factor to be G3 or G4, it doesn't matter, mu rho, and this factor to be eta nu eta sigma, that I would get the same thing. That's true either by rethinking the logic or because the Riemann curvature tensor has an exchange symmetry where if I exchange both of these pairs of indices, I get the same thing. So that's why, this should have an IK. So this identity suffices to calculate both of the cross terms in this expression. If I pair this with this so that I have a 1g3 and 2 etas, then I know what I get. If I pair this with this, I get 2 etas and a g3, I get the same thing. If I pair this with this, then I get the first term with the first term. Then I get two, three metrics, and a Riemann curvature with all of the indices spatial. I'll just put dot, dot, dot here for some terms that we showed how to calculate. And then I can use the Gauss-Kedazzi equation to simplify that. So I have all the ingredients for the calculation. And let me just summarize what you get. This one I didn't make a, decided not to make a homework problem. I just summarized because it's kind of a pain to write the whole thing out. If you put in the Gauss-Kedazzi equation for the first term and use our previous calculation part two and part one to do all the other terms, then you end up with the following nice result. R3 is KL minus the standard way you'll see this written is, so one more just very minor thing is that this square root of minus g4 is equal to, it was convenient to keep it as g4 throughout the calculation so that I could do these integrations by parts. It's equal to, we showed this last time using the matrix factorization, although I didn't really emphasize it, that its determinant is n times square root of g3. So this is usually written with a, like that, with a factor of n. And then what I have here is the 3 scalar curvature. And these terms are usually just written using this equation, we're going to get rid of all of the 4 notation and just use 3 quantities. So it's understood that the indices are raised and lowered with the 3 metric, even though I put the G3s here explicitly just to make it clear that I meant G3 and not G4. So this is the famous ADM action. So I have about 15 minutes left. I think that is enough time to go through. Let me raise this. Won't be enough time to finish, but that's the end of the GR machinery. And the reason that I was building up all the machinery is so that we could work out the classical theory of perturbations in single field inflation with a reasonable amount of algebra and no cheating by saying, well, if you go off and do 20 pages of algebra by yourself, here's what answer you'll get. I will cheat a little bit by using the dot, dot, dot to refer to algebra that you will get to experience soon in your problem set. Okay, so we built up a lot of machinery. We have the ADM variables. We understand that at some point during the calculation, we will want to fix the gauge to get rid of the unphysical gauge modes. And that we also want to get rid of non-dynamical modes by writing things down in ADM variables. And then solving the equations of motion for N and NI will not have time derivatives. I can solve for those fields in terms of the other variables and eliminate them from the action. So I'm going to go through how this works out in the case of single field inflation. So the first step is to take the action of single field inflation and just write it in terms of the ADM variables. There's some freedom to permute the steps in this calculation, but this is the order that I did them in. So the answer that you'll get is the following. And single field inflation looks like this in ADM variables. Where EIJ is just the intrinsic curvature without the n to the minus 1. And I'm omitting, everything is 3, so I'm omitting all of the like G3, NABLA3, and so on. And E is GIJ, EIJ. And matter action. I like removing the N so that it's explicit which power of N appears on all the terms. The matter action is the following. In step 2, I'll put this over here. I specialize the metric to perturbed FRW. So GIJ is A of t squared times delta IJ plus a perturbation. I also, in this step, set delta phi to 0, which is one of our 4 gauge conditions. There are 3 more gauge conditions, which are defined by splitting the first order perturbation HIJ into a trace piece, which is called zeta, and a traceless symmetric piece, gamma ij, and then imposing a gauge condition on gamma ij. But I actually found it simpler to postpone that step in the gauge fixing to later in the calculation. So with the metric specialized to FRW and this partial gauge fixing, then the result turned out to look like this. Needless to say, working this out is a homework problem. Okay. plus. Notice that with this gauge condition imposed, if delta phi is 0, then phi is just a function of time. And it follows that v of phi is also just a function of time. And so when I write things like phi dot or v, those are just functions of time in the background that don't carry perturbations. Now, in order to make further progress, I found that I needed some tricks that were kind of hard to see. So one thing, and here's a way to think about the tricks. One thing that ought to be true when we expand the action in perturbations, the perturbations here are hij and ni. If I write n, the ABM laps as 1 minus 1 plus eta, then this three metric, this vector, and this scalar are the first order perturbations. So one thing that ought to be true is that when I expand the action in these perturbations, I should get terms that are second order in the perturbations. And I will have terms that are first order in the perturbations. I'll have terms like square root of g times r3. Well, I guess r3 is 0 here. But there are terms over here, like this v term is a zeroth order term. I should not expect to get terms that are first order in the perturbations. And that is true because whenever I have a solution, a background, which is a solution of the equations of motion, and then I expand in perturbations around the background, that I never get first order terms because the first order terms look schematically, if the thing that I'm expanding is the action, the first order terms will look schematically like, you know, the functional derivatives of S with respect to the fields times first order perturbations in the fields. And this is zero because the background solution is supposed to satisfy the equations of motion. In other words, generally speaking, if I have a function and I find its minimum and I expand in powers of fluctuations away from the minimum, then the derivative is zero, so I only expect to get second order terms. Same thing is true if I take a configuration of least action and expand in powers. So it's not clear how that's working out here because for example, there appear to be terms that are first order in eta. If I expand this n as 1 plus eta, I'll get a term that looks like eta times v. And likewise here and here. But if you stare at this for a bit, you can see that they are canceling because of the first order in eta terms are canceling because of Friedmann's equation. So one way to say it is that I'm going to replace this h squared by Friedmann's equation in the form h squared h squared is rho over 3m Planck squared, which here is, let's say, 1 over 3m Planck squared times 1 half phi dot squared plus b. If I use Friedmann's equation in this form then and plug in for the h squared, then this phi dot squared term will cancel, and I'll get a term proportional to n to the minus 1 v. So when I plug that in, I get a little cancellation. You can see terms start to cancel, but we're moving terms between the gravitational part of the action and the matter part of the action, which I thought was sort of interesting. So you get, as a small cancellation, you get this. Okay. So that gets rid of the terms that are first order in eta. This term, if I expand it in powers of eta, the first order term is zero. But if you stare at this for a bit, it looks like there are more first order terms, not in eta, but in fluctuations in the metric. So this term is a first order term. If I expand square root of g3, it will contain a term. We saw that when we perturbed the metric, the determinant picked up a term proportional to the trace of h. And so it looks like there's a non-zero term there. And also here on the right-hand side, this is a zeroth order term. If I expand the square root of minus g3, I pick up a term proportional to the trace of h. And so it looks like there's a trace of h times v on the right-hand side. So there's another trick that uses Friedman's equation to get rid of those terms. But I'll talk about it. That one takes a little longer to explain, so I'll start there next time. Thanks.